Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Our special guest today is John Malden. He's actually one of my very favorite authors. He's the chairman of Malden Economics, an economic and investment strategy research firm, and president of Millennium Wave Investments. John is a renowned financial expert, a New York Times best-selling author, a pioneering online commentator, and the publisher of Thoughts from the Frontier, or Frontline, sorry, one of the first publications to provide investors with free, unbiased information and guidance, and one of the most widely read investor newsletters in the world. Each week, 1 million readers turn to John Malden to gain a better understanding of Wall Street, global markets, and the drivers of the world economy. He lives in Dallas, Texas, and he is the father of 7 children, 5 that have been adopted. And John, welcome to our show.
Well, it's good to be with you, sir.
I've read your books. I know that those would not be easy tasks to write. So I thank you for taking time to do that.
I appreciate it.
They're not easy reads. The title, Endgame.
Well, I like to think they're very easy to read.
You know what?
They may not be as fun a read as some people would like. But
they're understandable.
They definitely are understandable.
Yeah. When you get a hold of one, you're thinking, oh boy, Endgame. And then they're really not terrifying. They're sort of, okay, this is a likely scenario that's going to play out, and this is what you do to protect your family. And in a way, they both have had very orchestrated, careful suggestions saying that you can come out okay from these scenarios.
Right. I mean, we're not doom and gloom. It's not, you know, we're not looking at buying firearms and dried food. We do feel that there's very optimistic the way you look at the future. You just have to make sure that you are not in front of the policies that central banks and governments are doing, and so and you don't have to be. There's nothing requiring you to not set yourself up to where you can do quite well in the coming years.
Now, you feel that when we were at the peak of the problem of the financial crisis, that these policies were necessary during that time and maybe shortly thereafter, and now that they've continued far too long. Would that be accurate?
All right. They're now actually, I think, becoming counterproductive. They're creating the scenario that we're seeing today. Now investors are worried about what happens when you take us off the morphine. There is a moment in time when you have financial crisis, when you have liquidity, that is totally appropriate for central banks to inject liquidity into the system. You don't want the banking system freezing up. You can make the argument, and we did, that part of the problem for the 2008 crisis was caused by the policies of the Fed going back into the early Greenspan era when they helped create a bubble. But
well, what was interesting about that, they didn't.
When you have a financial crisis, you do have to have a central bank to step in. What they've done since then is try to fine-tune the economy. They've added a third unwritten mandate to what their public mandates are, and that's to help boost asset prices.
Correct.
And that's not the responsibility of a central bank. The responsibility for asset prices should be left to the market. The value of a stock shouldn't be subject to the Federal Reserve keeping rates artificially low and encouraging increased debt. The problem of the last crisis, and indeed most financial crises, is not too little debt, but too much debt to begin with. So creating a situation where you want to encourage people to borrow even more. It's kind of like telling the alcoholic, "Well, here's a fifth of whiskey. This is the cure for your drinking problem." What you want to do is to encourage a lower debt profile, a lower leverage profile, and in fact, the correlation between lower leverage and total indebtedness in the system, not just government or private, but government and private, and the actual growth of that economy is pretty tight. And when it gets over that 260, 300%, and we're at 360 now, then leverage, then growth, in fact, does decrease. And this seems to be across countries. There's a point at which the debt is no longer productive debt. It becomes consumption debt. And so when you're borrowing to consume today, what you're really doing is you're taking future consumption and you're bringing it into today. And at some point, you've created so much future consumption that's been brought forward, you're beginning to dip into current consumption. That future consumption that you borrowed finally comes. That future shows up, and you've already spent your money, and now you're having to repay it. And so it's actually a depressant to growth over time. The point of leverage, of properly constructed leverage, should be to buy an asset that produces an income which helps pay off not just the interest, but the principal as well. That's a proper use of leverage. Simply to purchase something else it may be a perfectly utilitarian decision for an individual. You might decide, I want to buy a new car today, and then I feel better about myself, and it makes sense with my current consumption and pattern and income to have this type of car or this type of house. I mean, I'm in the process of finalizing a mortgage on a new apartment that I bought, and I am leveraged. It's the first debt I've had in a long time, so I'm... My personal intention is to pay it off far faster than the term on the mortgage. But I think it's an appropriate investment for where I am and the risks and so forth. Simply to borrow money to put on a credit card or a student loan for an asset that may or may not pay off over time, But everybody does that. Eventually, you've brought so much consumption forward, you're going to reduce current growth.
Requiring more stimulation.
And then it requires more stimulation, and that stimulation then becomes less effective. It's nothing cataclysmic. It's not a, going off the cliff event. It's just a, oh my goodness, we're slowing down because we've brought, because we've already consumed this year's crop.
Mm-hmm.
We brought it. It was, another way of saying that, and there was a famous German economist who said it, is that debt is future consumption denied. In the sense of when we spend money today, and borrow money today to spend something, we are saying in the future we are not going to spend that money on consumption, but we're going to use it to pay the debt back. Because we all recognize intuitively that there is a limit to how much we as individuals can borrow. There's a limit to how much we can consume today. And there's a limit in reality to what cultures and countries can do. And when countries get to that state, when they borrow too much, they have to either go to a slower growth period, to pay down that debt. They have to inflate the debt away. They have to default on the debt. They have to do something with that debt. And, you know, the popular way to do that is to grow your way out of it. Well, the only way to do that is to stop incurring more debt. And, you know, that's become very unpopular these days. That's called austerity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do what we did in the 90s, we stopped growing our debt, and a naturally resilient U.S. economy eventually grew its way out of it. We began to pay the debt back down. And I remember in, you know, 2002, 2003, we had Greenspan and other members of the Federal Reserve actually worrying about what would happen when we paid all the U.S. Debt off. Where would, because there is a certain amount of U.S. National debt, treasury debt, that under the way our current system is structured, there's a certain amount of it that you're required just to make the banking system and other things function,
mm-hmm.
Because we've all got used to that. And so they were openly worrying about what happens if we pay all this out and we can't grease the wheels, we can't make the system work with that debt. What do we substitute for that? What, you know, how do we go about creating overnight paper and liquidity? All the things that are that we as investors and as depositors at banks and financial institutions don't think about. It's in the background, but it's part of the plumbing.
It seems to me that when it hit the fan in 2008, that if they had a successful blueprint they could have looked at, that's not what they did. They were making policies on the fly.
Well, they had to. There was no game plan. There was no looking back and, gee, we've done this experiment 10 times. We know which buttons to push, which levers to pull. They had to provide massive amounts of liquidity. They had, I mean, the reality is that, you know, banks simply didn't trust each other. The overnight repo markets and interbank markets had collapsed, especially in Europe. I find, you know, what the SEC and the various attorney generals and the regulatory authorities in Europe, when they started fining Barclays and other banks for falsifying their overnight rates. And I find that almost laughable. I was writing in 2008 that there was no overnight bank credit interbank market. Therefore, whatever number they were giving us was something they made up. It had to be because there was nothing trading.
Correct.
So the guy at Barclays or HSBC or Lloyd's or B of A or whatever, they had no way to say, well, this is what our paper's trading at. And then, you know, you get the 16 banks together and then they say, well, this is the average of the interbank market. It was clearly a fictitious number. And as it turns out, the regulators were encouraging them to do that. And then, of course, they came back and fined them for doing that very thing. And I think that's going to, that could come back to bite us in the next crisis, whenever that happens in the future. Because banks are going to look back and say, whoa, wait a minute. If we do what is good for the system, which is in fact lie, because if all of those banks had gone to the industry association, which gave us LIBOR, for which $100 trillion worth of transactions in our world are based. I mean, and they had gone to that association and say, well, we aren't trading, there's nothing happening. So that they would have had to announce, well, there is actually no, overnight rate, there is no LIBOR rate. Dear God, the next day the world would have completely collapsed. So they had to lie with the full collusion and encouragement of the regulators, and then they get fined for it. Well, the next time, that's not going to happen, because now they know that, you know, what's going to what will happen is that 5 years later, a regulator will come up and say, well, you know, you're easy picking, so we're going to go after you because we can get a scalp. And the next time the bankers are going to say, well, you can have a scalp, but it won't be mine. And so we had some very, very short-sighted regulators. And we've gotten far afield from where we were going. But it's all of these little things come together to give us a climate that is manipulated, controlled, encouraged, prodded by 12 men or 12 men and women in a committee in Washington D.C. at the Fed, the governors of the Bank of Japan, the members of the European Central Bank, the governors of the Bank of England, thinking they can manipulate their own economies, thinking that they can spur employment and liquidity, which in fact what they need to do is to get the governments to say, let's get out of the way, because what we need is more income, not more debt.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to encourage entrepreneurs and businesses to provide more services and to compete and to get out of their way.
Tonight there's a State of the Union message. Do you think you're going to hear any of those themes?
You'll hear platitudes, but I think what you'll hear from the president is that he wants to see more government intervention and more government involvement, not less. So I don't expect to hear what I would like to hear, which is, how is government going to make it easier for entrepreneurs to make money, make it easier for businesses to open businesses and create new markets? I would like to see and hear something about an increase in free trade agreements, and all of those things that are pro-business, pro-entrepreneur, not necessarily pro-bank or because in essence that's what quantitative easing was. It was the Federal Reserve injecting money into the top of the system to increase asset prices, which in fact that's what, you know, the banks made out like a bandit. People who were who owned stocks and other assets have done very well. You know, the average guy out on the street hasn't benefited as much. It's trickle-down monetary policy.
Yeah, and the spread grew and the resentment grew.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In essence, you have people complaining about the disparity of incomes and wealth, but then you create a monetary policy whose primary beneficiaries are the wealthy.
Right, it assures the outcome.
And then you wonder why we get the results we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's been, you know, a two-edged sword, you have low interest rates if you're buying real estate. You're getting some financing that's probably historically low or close to it. But for somebody that's spent their whole life saving, they're not getting rewarded very well.
That's one of the great ironies. When they say they want to increase consumption, well, then you hurt savers by giving them less interest. That means they have less to spend. That means retirees actually have to be more conservative, not less conservative, because they're getting less money. They have to worry about making their money last through their, you know, to the end of their lives. It's counterproductive. The current economic thinking doesn't see it that way. I mean, it's a very neo-Keynesian, and Keynes was very focused on consumption as the driver of an economy, rather than income being the driver of an economy, rather than production being, you know, what really matters.
The consequences that we've just been talking about, some of them are unintended. Were there any intentional consequences, saying, okay, we push this button, we know that's going to occur? Like the low yield, okay, they knew that had to occur. Does that force investors to make decisions other than they might?
It doesn't force them, but it certainly prods them and pushes them.
Okay.
And that's what happens is we get a reach for yield. We've seen credit spreads come down. You're getting less on high yield bonds than you used to. You're having to take more risk for less return. The Fed wants us to take more risk because they think, if we take more risk, that will produce more in the economy. But some of that risk is not necessarily, it doesn't increase productivity. It doesn't increase income. It just increases increases potential volatility in the next crisis. I mean, if I've got a high yield bond and if I'm getting 8%, whereas I used to get 12%, and I've got that, say, spread over, 40 companies. So if one of them, has a bump and, I have to settle for 75 cents on the dollar, well, that reduces my overall income a fraction of 1%, on the entire portfolio. And if I'm making 12%, then that takes it down closer to 11%. But if I'm making 8%, then that's a bigger chunk, and it takes it down close to 7%. And so I've got less margin for error. I'm taking more risk. And it's still the same company. I'm taking the same amount of risk in terms of the lending that I'm doing, but I'm getting less return for it. And
I think what happens
that hasn't increased productivity at all. What they want is for businesses to go out and buy more tools and machines and build more buildings and to take more risk like that. And lower rates sometimes don't always encourage the productive increase of the economy.
You had mentioned one of your thoughts, you'd like to see some free trade agreements open up. And in essence, and we've only got another minute and a half in this segment, currency war is kind of started with Japan and the yen. So what are the odds that we actually go the other way and have less willing trade and more problems in that arena?
I'm not quite certain how to answer that. Let's rephrase that just once again.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Bruce.
Just talking about the currency war, and we're going to run out of time here in a minute. What the Japanese did to their yen, they've begun devaluing. Is that going to be followed
right.
by other currencies? And again, we only have one more minute.
Well, you're going to see a lot of countries want to try to increase. Everybody wants to grow their way out of the problem. Everybody wants their currency to go down so their businesses can sell more. The problem is everybody's currency can't go down at the same time.
Okay.
Somebody has to buy. Somebody to run a trade deficit, somebody has to run a trade surplus. So the Japanese are just trying to get out in front of the process. And that's what you get these competitive devaluations. The Japanese have just launched the first major missile in what I think is a coming currency war.
Okay. Well, with that, we'll end our first segment. We've been joined by John Malden. You can go to www.maldeneconomics.com, and I receive everything the man writes and would suggest you take a look at it as well. John, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you very, very much, too, sir.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.